that.
Do you like that little Friday afternoon off?
The mics are on.
Mics on, guys.
Mics are on.
Mics are on.
Let's go.
Tell me about your weekend.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Monday, 16th of February. Just to make a brief announcement, I think we're going to be holding 2468, is that right?
Yes.
Toward the end. We'll be doing 2468 last. There's a large number of folks who want to testify, so we want to make sure we fit it into the room. The room time, and let's see. What are we going to start with, Madam Administrator? 2523?
Yeah.
Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2523. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2523 modifies the treatment limits for certain chiropractic physicians and naturopathic physicians who provide medical services to injured workers through managed care organizations. It also requires the MCOs to allow chiropractic physicians and naturopathic physicians who are members of the MCO to serve as attending physician for the injured workers for the life of the claim. And we have two individuals that have signed up.
Who do we have here to testify?
Proponent.
Please call them.
Vern Sabo and Majoris has somebody who's against. Do you want them at the same time?
Oh, we can take one at a time. Let's start with Dr. Sabo.
Chair Green Lake, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association.
Welcome, Dr. Sabo.
Good morning. Afternoon. This bill is pretty straightforward. Currently, we have four basic MCOs that allow varying treatment numbers, length of care, and attending physician status. Managed care organizations allow us to be attending physician for the life of the claim. Two do not. We have one MCO where we have 12 visits or 30 days before we have to pre-certify with the medical director for further care. We have two that allow 18 visits and 60 days before further care has to be authorized, and then we have one that allows 20 visits and 60 days. And as I say, there's two
that allow. Dr. Chabot, are you talking about CCOs in this case?
No, this is okay. MCOs.
Specifically?
Managed care organizations, workers' compensation.
Great, okay, thank you.
So, and we've inserted naturopathic physicians who also treat injured workers. I've got a lot of, or several chiropractic physicians that are duly licensed and do prolotherapy and other types of treatments. What's key about the consistency of the number of the treatments and visits is less important than attending physician status to us. Currently, when we're attending physicians, we can advocate better for our injured worker patients and ask for continuing care. But more importantly, we can provide a closing examination when we believe that that injured worker has reached maximal therapeutic benefit or maximum medical improvement. At that time, we do ranges of motion and other testing for neurologic deficits and the like, and come up with what are referred to as findings of impairment, medical impairment, which is loss of function. We can also rate the impairment if the physician is schooled and in rating impairment. Now, if we can't do the closing exam findings, if we're not the attending, there's two of the MCOs who are not attending physicians, Caremark Comp and Kaiser. Now, the problem with that is the great majority of closing exams then are performed by independent medical examiners that work for the independent medical examiner vendors. And that's not a good situation for injured workers. We had a 2004 unbiased IME study done by the Department of Consumer and Business Services that revealed that those examinations were less than unbiased. In fact, the executive summary stated that 52% of the IME doctors themselves indicated the system was biased against injured workers. What's important about that is that those findings of impairment, loss of function, no longer go to an impartial body, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which used to have impairment raters and disability raters. They go back to the insurer. And the insurer both rates the impairment and disability. If there's no rateable impairment, there can be no award, cash award for permanent partial disability for that injured worker. That's a horrible situation for injured workers. And so we want to be able to perform the closing examination for our injured worker patients. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Thank you, Chair. What kind of injuries are you treating these workers for? Can you give me some examples?
Primarily, Chair Greenlake, Representative Bueller, members of the committee, primarily musculoskeletal conditions, everything from lumbosacral sprain, facet joint dysfunction, lumbosacral sprains, sacroiliac sprains, intervertebral disc herniations that are non-surgical, carpal tunnel, primarily we also treat extremities, knee injuries, foot and ankle, shoulder and so forth, those types of injuries.
One more question, please. In what kind of training does a typical naturopathic physician receive with regards to these types of injuries?
Well, I think that parallels what chiropractic physicians get locally at the University of Western States. They are schooled in neurophysiology and neurology, orthopedics, clinical orthopedics, basically the foundational clinical sciences needed to work someone up and determine a diagnosis and course of care.
Thank you. Has MLEC had a chance to weigh in on this one?
No, they have not. They've heard testimony, but they have not voted on it, per se.
Do you have a copy of the bill with you?
Do I have a copy of the bill with me? I do not.
Let me read you. The main issue is, I think, line 34 on page 3, which adds to the statute, authorizes chiropractic physicians and naturopathic physicians to serve as attending physicians for the life of the injured worker's claim. Oh, somebody got you a bill. Good. I'm looking at page 3, line 34. I wonder if this is the heart of the bill as you see it, or
I think you're correct. It's the attending physician status that is the angst of the MCOs, particularly the ones that don't allow chiropractic and naturopathic physicians to be attending physicians. Though they're all going to testify against the bill.
What are the consequences of being an attending physician?
It allows us primarily to advocate for our injured worker patients, allows us to perform a closing exam and provide findings of impairment, which is very crucial to the award of permanent partial disability if there are findings of impairment.
So it's not about the continued treatment at that point. It's about other findings in workman's compensation.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Okay. One more quick question. Thank you, Chair Greenlake. Why don't you think it should be the prerogative of the MCO to get the input or transfer care to another physician or caregiver if it's to the best interest of the patient to get that kind of perspective?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bueller, members of the committee, so what you're asking me is why would we object the MCO taking the patient from us and sending them somewhere else? Because a great majority of providers don't want to see injured workers, and the panels are very restrictive. And also, quite frankly, it's our specialty. And At a recent, well, it's really wasn't a recent, but it was a Disability Rating Advisory Committee meeting at DCBS that I attended, the three employees from Safe Corporation, the one from Liberty Northwest, confirmed that the great majority of their closing exams are performed by IME doctors or IME vendors. It's a horrible situation for injured workers. It's a biased environment, and that's where they end up.
But a closing exam is different than initiating treatment or trying to get the injured worker to the best possible person to treat their injury. That, those are two different issues.
Correct.
So why would you be against them getting to the person most skilled to take care of their injury?
Well, I would
put the closing exam off.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, members of the committee, I would disagree with that assumption. I don't think that's what's happening. Some of the cases, yes, especially if it's a possible surgical case that we simply, it's a disc herniation with true radiculopathy that just simply starts to, we start to see paresis, they start to go south. But for the great majority of uncomplicated low back injuries and so forth, that's not happening.
Okay. Dr. Sable, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would you please call the next witness?
Ramona St. George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ramona St. George. I am the president and CEO of Majors Health Systems. We are a certified MCO in the state of Oregon and other western states. I'm here today to provide
a workers' compensation MCO.
Yes, a workers' compensation MCO. That's our only line of business. Excuse me. I'm here today to provide information in opposition to House Bill 2523. First and foremost, as the chairman mentioned, this bill has not yet been heard. Or it's been heard but not voted on by MLAC.
Would you explain what MLAC is, please?
It's the Management Labor Advisory Committee. That is a committee that was created in the 1990 workers' compensation reforms, and their purpose is essentially to vet policy and legislation to ensure that the system remains and changes to the system remain in the best interest of the two primary stakeholders, which are injured workers and employers, not MCOs, not attorneys, not physicians, but the injured worker and the employer.
And for MLAC action, it requires a majority of both parties. Is that right, if I remember correctly?
Yes.
Thank you. We have some new members in the committee that hadn't heard these things.
Yeah, we do recognize, Mr. Chairman, that some of the newer legislators who aren't the old dinosaurs like I am, who actually served on the initial MLAC committee 20-some-odd years ago, may not understand what that committee is about. So thank you for letting me clarify that. MCOs are centers of innovation for the delivery of quality, cost-effective, efficient health care for injured workers. That is, in fact, a statutory mandate of MCOs to do exactly that. One size of delivery does not fit all. Lest I be viewed as anti-chiropractic, I, in fact, treat with a chiropractor occasionally, and Majors does allow chiropractic physicians to be attending physicians for injured workers within our MCO. But some MCOs do not allow that. Some offer various levels of attending physician status to chiropractic physicians. Flexibility is the key to maintaining a healthy, dynamic delivery system, and it allows us to adapt to various markets, urban versus rural, markets where there are more innovative delivery systems or coordinated delivery systems, et cetera, along with the industries in an area that we serve and the type of injuries that we might see come out of those. Creating mandates for the MCOs stifle this ability. In fact, MCOs were created to have greater flexibility in the definition of attending physician and fewer mandates than outside of an MCO. In addition, this change would add really nothing as far as access for chiropractic physicians to the system. In 2013, the legislature created a requirement to include what we call the come-along provisions for chiropractors in MCOs. That means that if a worker has a history of treating with a chiropractor, they then have a workers' comp injury, that and they're enrolled in an MCO, that they could bring that chiropractor along as their treating physician within the terms and conditions of the MCO. That was established in essence to create access to chiropractic care for injured workers. That was the theory. In fact, it didn't change anything, at least in our MCO. It has stayed relatively steady before that law and after that law at about 6% of injured workers choosing chiropractic care. In fact, the year before, 2013, when the law went before the law went into effect, 6.5% of injured workers chose chiropractic care. After the law went into effect for 2014, only 6% chose. So the theory that throwing open the doors will create an influx of patients choosing chiropractic, I don't think is borne out by the evidence. Finally, the language of the bill is problematic. This bill requires attending physician status for the life of the claim. And speaking to Representative Bueller's questions about the ability to change a worker's level of care if the one they are currently in is not appropriate. Let's say they're treating with a family practice physician and they really need to be treated by an orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon, et cetera.
I'm sure that Bueller will drink to that.
then the MCO has the ability to say, injured worker, based on our medical review by physicians, it's determined that you're better treated at this level of care. The worker certainly has appeal rights to that, and his attending physician would have appeal rights if they think that's an erroneous decision. But the language of the bill that the chiropractic or naturopathic physician would have the attending physician status for the life of the claim would effectively prohibit us from being able to transfer that care, whether or not chiropractic treatment was still medically appropriate for that injured worker. I would additionally submit that MCOs should retain the authority to determine the number of visits and time periods before pre-authorization is required for additional treatment. Again, chiropractic physicians are attending physicians in our network, but we look at all physical medicine modalities being provided, including physical therapy, occupational therapy, osteopathic manipulations, because these physical medicine modalities are one of the biggest cost drivers in the workers' comp system today. And so while we allow them attending physician status, we're keeping a close eye to ensure that the worker is making objective gains on an ongoing basis, and that we don't need to move that to a different level of care. It's in the worker's best interest if they've stalled in physical medicine modalities that perhaps we have them evaluated as a surgical candidate, or perhaps they're medically stationary, and unfortunately that's as good as they're going to get. You know, there's a number of factors. As far as Dr. Sabo's comments about IMEs being used to close claims, there may be a consulting exam or an IME obtained to get the measurements to close an injured worker's claim, but that requires the attending physician to agree with that physician's closing exam findings. The insurer cannot unilaterally close that claim based on an IME or a consulting exam. So I will be happy to address any questions that you might have from my perspective.
Are there any questions? Yes. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, has this issue been before IMLAC before? Is this something new that the chiropractic communities came with, or have you been approached with it, I should say?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Widener, this is somewhat of a perennial bill in one form or another. Last of the regular sessions, there was an any willing provider law in front of us. There was, There was another chiropractic attending physician bill, and I apologize, I can't remember what last session it was. But yes, it comes up most every regular session.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2523 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2678. And invite Senator Bates to join us at the podium.
And Laurel.
Can you tell us what we have while he's on his way up, please?
Sure. And there's other individuals at this panel. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2678 permits a licensed nurse practitioner to perform sterilization procedures on male patients, a.k.a. vasectomies.
And you say there's a couple more to join with this panel?
I believe so. Laura Terrell Patton, and then I need to get somebody on the phone. If
Laura can protect you, Senator Bates. That's good.
And Tricia Stump will be on the phone.
Thank you for calling the Central Oregon Health Center. If you know the extension of your party, you may dial it now. Please hold while I transfer your call.
Thank you for coming over from your committee.
Hello, this is Tricia.
Welcome. Tricia, this is Sandy from the House Healthcare Committee. You are on the phone now.
Hi.
Okay.
Senator Bates, will you lead us off, please?
I'll try to. For the record, Senator Alan Bates from District 3 in Southern Oregon. I'm also a primary care physician, and just to be completely open about this, I do a lot of vasectomies. So we'll have a little conversation here. I'm here in favor of this bill. Frankly, I didn't know that nurse practitioners were barred from doing vasectomies.
No,
I assumed they
either.
Were doing them in various clinics and places where they do a lot of vasectomies. And so I was a little surprised to find this out. So I think it's time to make a change. That said, I'm a little concerned about the way the bill is written from a technical point of view, and that there are some issues here that I think we need to look at. We'll probably be offering amendments to just sort of clean the bill up. For instance, one of them on line 23 says, nurse practitioner may perform a sterilization procedure on a male. Sterilization is an overbroad term. There's lots of ways you can sterilize somebody. And what we're talking about here is a simple vasectomy where you interrupt the vas deferens and not allow sperm to progress and therefore sterilize the male from that point of view. It's also something that can be, under certain conditions, reversed.
You have an amendment coming forward.
I do.
Clarify that.
Yeah, and we're trying to find out the exact wording. We know we need the word sterilization replaced by vasectomy. The question whether it's called a partial vasectomy or not, because a full vasectomy is a much bigger operation and occasionally it's done. They're also above that, there's two paragraphs talking about the 30-day wait period for permission. Generally speaking, that's been applied only to Medicaid, not to private insurance or other insurances. We want to look at that carefully to make sure we're not applying something to nurse practitioners that doesn't apply to the general medical community. We don't want to put a restriction on them. Many times, men will come in and have a short period of time or have a holiday coming up. They want to get their vasectomy done while they have time to recover. And we don't like to delay them for a month or more until we can get it into their schedules where it works for them. So these are the kind of considerations we want to make sure are clear in this bill. And we may offer some technical changes, but we are not opposed to the bill. It's a great bill, and we should pass it.
Great. Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Senator Bates?
Chair and members of the committee, with your permission, I'd like to go back to my other committee. Is that okay?
Wouldn't you rather stay here?
Well, seeing what you just finished, I'm okay to stay. And I'll be glad to stay and listen to others speak. And if there's any questions I can answer, I'd be glad to stay and try to answer those.
I think you're free to go.
Okay.
Thank you very
Thank
much,
Thank you, Mr.
Senator.
Chair. Thank you,
Senator.
Ms. Patton?
Chair Greenlich and members of the House Healthcare Committee, my name is Laura Terrell Patton. I'm Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Thank you for your time today. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2678. As reproductive health care advocates, we know firsthand what happens when Oregonians have increased access to birth control. The rate of unintended pregnancy goes down. In fact, the Guttmacher Institute just reported last month that Oregonians' unintended pregnancy rate dropped by 17.4% between 2002 and 2010, which marks the nation's largest drop across this decade. To continue this momentum, House Bill 2678 will help remedy a gap in access to men's reproductive health care. Currently, patients at Planned Parenthood health centers are experiencing long delays in accessing vasectomy care because of a shortage of providers. In early 2014, Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette had 100 men on our waiting list, which can take us up to 6 months to get through. And this is far too long of a wait for pregnancy prevention. Vasectomy is one of the most cost-effective permanent forms of birth control available to families. Compared with permanent birth control for women, vasectomy is less expensive, less invasive, and is associated with much lower risk of complications. Yet, despite costing much less than tubal sterilization, vasectomy is performed at less than half the rate of tubal sterilization in the United States. Additionally, we believe it is crucial to provide Oregon men with the resources to take a more active role in family planning to better ensure that their contraceptive needs and that of their partner are being met. Making decisions about family planning is one of the most important things men can do to prioritize their sexual health and to participate with their partners in the family planning that they want. House Bill 2678 would remove the unnecessary prohibition and bring Oregon policy in line with the current scope of practice for trained nurse practitioners. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon strongly supports this cost-effective, medically accurate remedy to empower men to take control of their family planning needs.
You want to comment?
No.
Great, thank you. Are there questions?
Yeah, question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Explain to me the level of training a typical nurse practitioner has in any type of surgical procedure, one which they'd learn sterile technique in those sorts of skills.
Chair Greenlich and Representative Bueller, members of the committee, Sarah Hickenbacken is here from the Board of Nursing. I would like to direct those questions to her.
Okay. Great.
Thank you. And she's up on our next panel. I don't know if you want to
No, well, let's wait till the next panel.
Okay.
Let's finish with you. And Ms. Stumpf, are you prepared to testify?
Yes, I am.
Would you please identify yourself and go for it?
Yeah, I'm Tricia Stumpf, the Regional Manager of Health Services for Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette, and I manage the health care as part of my role. Chair Greenlich and the members of the House Health Care Committee, we take family planning services seriously, and we want to see both men and women have access to high-quality contraceptive services when they need them. Currently, access is inhibited by lack of providers for vasectomies. In early 2014, we had 100 men on the waiting list to receive vasectomies. A list that length can take us 6 months to get through because we simply do not have enough providers available. As we speak, we have 92 men around the state who are waiting for vasectomies, and the earliest available appointment in Portland is mid-May. We have submitted written testimony from Ryan Brown, a Bend resident, who had to wait for 8 months to finally receive the procedure. Unfortunately, his story is just one of many in and around Bend and around the state. We know that delays in contraceptive services increase the chances of unintended pregnancies. At Planned Parenthood affiliates in Washington, nurse practitioners are trained to provide vasectomies. NPs have been providing vasectomies for more than a decade. One nurse practitioner estimates she has performed more than 1,000 procedures alone. We have submitted testimony from Dr. Robert C. McIntyre, a vasectomy provider and a former medical director from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest. He trains nurse practitioners to provide vasectomies, and in his testimony, it includes the competency checklist used in that training. We know that it is already within the scope of practice of MPs in Oregon, and with proper training, we would also be able to gain expertise in the procedure like our colleagues in Washington. It is also important to increase access to vasectomy so men can take a more active role in family planning to better ensure that their contraceptive needs and that of their partner are being met. Making decisions about family planning is one of the most important things men can do to prioritize their sexual health and to participate with their partners in planning the family they want. Thank you, and sincerely, Tricia Stump, the Regional Manager of Health Services for Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette.
Thank you for testifying.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Beth, would you call the next panel, please?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, will you indulge me for just a quick second?
I'm always willing to indulge you.
Okay. Well, I just want to say this is my bill, and so I apologize for being here late. I was testifying.
I'm sorry that I called it. That's
okay. So I'm sorry I was a little bit late. I was testifying in another committee about another bill that I'm working on as well. So I'm happy that they're here.
In response to this, it's Senator Biggs testified that it's going to need some amendments, specifically narrowing the sterilization concept down.
Okay.
Into what we're talking about. Will you coordinate working with the advocates and
sure.
get us those amendments?
Sure.
Good.
Tricia, do you want to stay on the phone or did you want to hang up?
Do you feel as though you need me? I'd be happy to stay. If not, I can go.
That, your call. I just didn't want to hang up on you if you wanted to listen.
I will let you guys continue, and if you need to reach out to me, I'll be at my desk.
Good.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jen Baker, Sarah Wickenhagen, and Courtney Dresser.
You should have introduced.
No worries.
I'm glad the two panels weren't entirely female panels to talk about male sterilization. Any more than we like panels of six men talking about female sterilization. Please go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker, here today to testify on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. Nurse Practitioners of Oregon is a special interest group within the Oregon Nurses Association, established in 1977 to enhance and at times maintain the progressive practice nurse practitioners have earned here in Oregon. In Oregon, NPs have earned a broad authority, practicing independently in both primary and specialty care. They diagnose and treat illness, prescribe and dispense medication, order and interpret tests, and provide comprehensive care to their patients. With proper training and education, NPs are also permitted to perform chest tube placement, bedside incision, and place arterial lines. Despite the fact that vasectomies fall within the scope of practice for nurse practitioners, Oregon's NPs have been expressly prohibited from performing the procedure in statute. House Bill 2678 would remedy this. Vasectomies are the most effective, safe, or more effective, safer, and less invasive, and more affordable than permanent birth control options for women. Unfortunately, here in Oregon, they're underutilized and not available, due in large part to the fact that we don't have enough providers performing them. Oregon's nurse practitioners have established themselves as a national leader in NP practice. However, Oregon's somewhat behind in this regard. Since 1996, NPs in Alaska and Washington State have been performing vasectomies, and their outcomes are good, equally as good as their physician colleagues. With appropriate education, training, and if necessary, health system credentialing, Oregon's NPs can safely perform vasectomies and help Oregon meet the current demand for this procedure. ONA and NPO urge your support of this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Wickenhagen. I'm a doctorally prepared family nurse practitioner, and I'm the advanced practice policy analyst at the Oregon State Board of Nursing. In addition, I'm a member of the Oregon Army National Guard and a medical director of the 2641 Aviation Unit here in Salem. I want to let everyone know that I'm here to submit informational testimony in regards to House Bill 2678, and basically to clarify to the committee that if this is removed from statutory limits that we currently have, it is certainly within the scope of a nurse practitioner to perform this skill set. It is also in line with what my colleagues at ONA have mentioned, that we are able to perform chest tubes, lumbar punctures, several different types of skilled procedures after we've had education and training and we've been credentialed by different health systems to perform those tasks. It's important to point out that if a nurse practitioner was not trained in this task, they would have to be precepted and they would have to meet the criteria for that health system and for that credentialing body. There are specific standards within health systems for the credentialing process, up to include the Joint Commission standards, which are the same that our physician colleagues would be held to as well. the rigor that we currently have in our own Nurse Practice Act, regardless of the current statute, protects the public and holds the individual licensees accountable for any procedures or misconduct that they would do if they performed something in error. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Representative Mueller, was that a question for this witness?
Yeah, so could you explain just the type of training, the number of procedures a typical nurse practitioner is able to experience in the course of a typical training?
Specifically to this procedure, I would say that there's probably variability. Again, in Oregon, we have not had this precedent. But typically for lumbar puncture, for chest tubes, the numbers are around 8 to 10 within hospital systems. Those are all peer-reviewed. They're all peer-directed or physician-directed trainings. And those competencies are renewed at least annually.
Okay. And a couple more questions.
Please, just go ahead.
And who would take care of the complications such as chronic testicular pain and infection and bleeding complications? And someone's going to be available to take care of those acute complications during the procedure. Who would do those?
So those complications would be the same as if any other advanced practice nurse was performing any other procedure and they required a higher level of care. They would make a telephone call. They would transfer the care to that patient to a higher level of care. If it was within an academic health center, it would be to the appropriate specialist and so forth.
And can you give me the exact peer-referenced article that compares outcomes to nurse practitioners doing this procedure versus a urologist or a physician?
I don't have that article. I'm sorry.
I don't have it in front of me, but we can certainly follow up with
That'd
you with it.
That'd be great.
Thank and you. I can try to find some further evidence.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Yes, please.
So you outlined a couple of things, procedures that nurse practitioners are already doing. I know I work for the Oregon Nurse Association, but I'm not a nurse, okay? In your opinion, are those procedures that you outlined that nurse practitioners are already permitted to do of a greater difficulty than what a vasectomy is? Like, my understanding of a vasectomy in terms of the procedure is it's really not very difficult.
I'm someone who used to perform lumbar punctures and someone who's done bone marrow aspirations and someone who has done chest tube placement. And in my humble opinion, I believe that those are much more difficult and require far more skill than a vasectomy.
And the nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon are currently permitted under credentialing and the scope that you outlined to do those things, right? And so really this is not a big leap well, you're not allowed to give an opinion, I guess, but to me this does not seem like a big leap to allow a nurse practitioner to be able to do a vasectomy.
Remember, Representative Nose, Bill Walton's famous words, minor surgery is surgery that happens to somebody else.
I will keep that in mind.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Nose, I would also say that first do no harm. We're nurse practitioners, we're skilled, we're trained, we're aware of our limits of our scope. This procedure is within our scope. There is current protection for the public of Oregon if there would be something that would occur, and there are multiple other providers that could render assistance if it was required, if there were complications.
Right on. Thank you very much.
Okay. Ms. Dress?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. We have had some healthy debate within our organization on this issue. There are some that feel that this is surgery and it's an easy no, but there are many, many who believe that that this is within a scope with the proper training and proper quality outcomes. So at this point, we are opposed to the bill as it is. We are handing around some amendments to the proponents, hoping we can get to a place of neutrality. I think what Dr. Bates or Senator Bates talked about in the definition is something that we're looking at too. So I feel we're close and we hope to get to a place of neutrality. I think as an association, we do want to see more access to contraceptive care. We believe vasectomies are part of that slate of options and they should be available. We understand the waiting issues and the time frames, and so we want to see what we can do to get to a place where we can get our providers to be on a neutral side.
Thank you. We work with Senator Bates and Representative Nose to the proponents to see if we can get this. Let's do it rapidly if we can.
Yes.
Are there any other questions to this panel? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2678. We have a problem in scheduling because I'd hope to get the public hearing on House Bill 2828 out of the way before we move to the last one, but our representative sponsor is off testifying.
Oh, no.
She had the same problem that I had.
Yeah.
See, I was in front of her committee.
Okay. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2468, and perhaps when Representative Smith Warner comes, we can maybe take a pause in that and open up another public hearing. So, Madam Administrator, what have we got with House Bill 2468?
2468 creates standards for insurers' provider networks. It establishes transparency about the providers covered by a plan. It specifies requirements for the scope of the insurer's network of providers. And I would say, Laura, they did a Laura Kelly.
Okay.
Letter lay.
Sir, Ms. Kelly, that would be great.
Okay.
Can we start with Commissioner Kelly, please? Welcome once again. Always love to see you here.
Thank you. Good to be here. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Kelly. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Today I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 2468, as well as the Dash 1 amendments that were released last week. And as was previously mentioned, this bill relates to healthcare network adequacy. I probably don't need to tell this committee, but health insurance is fairly complex. And you know, we find that it's often difficult for Oregon consumers to understand exactly what they're buying when they're in the process of purchasing a health insurance plan. And in particular, consumers don't always have the information that they need to determine whether a provider is in-network or out-of-network. Sometimes they're not even sure of what their needs might be down the line when they're going out to shop for a plan. And they don't always have the information to assess whether a particular plan or network is going to meet their financial and health needs. And we believe that Oregon consumers need tools to help them better understand the value of their insurance and what exactly their insurance plan gives them access to in terms of the care, the provider network, and lead them kind of on a path to being able to make better financial and health decisions. Since, you know, really the decision to purchase a health plan and then subsequent decisions about how to use care, which providers to see are, I think, really decisions that are complex and include both a health decision and financial decisions. So House Bill 2468 is intended to address this in two ways. The first way is by establishing minimum standards that would apply to provider networks that insurers set up for their health plans, and that would create a level playing field for consumers, for the providers of healthcare, and for insurance companies in the state. And then the second piece is by enhancing transparency of provider directories, and that really gets to this issue of making sure consumers have information to be able to make those decisions. So I'll first start by talking about the first point around minimum standards. And so the legislation as proposed would require insurers to submit to the department a report annually that would demonstrate how their provider networks for individual and small group health plans are providing adequate access to health care for their members. And we're proposing that there would be two different ways that an insurer could demonstrate compliance with network adequacy. The first is what we refer to as a factor-based approach. And this approach would allow insurers to demonstrate how they meet or how they're delivering, you know, an adequate network by showing how they comply with a selection of factors that would be defined in rule, and the factors would fall in four broad categories that are set forth in the proposed legislation. The second way that an insurer could demonstrate compliance is through a nationally recognized approach. And again, this right now would be determined in rule. But one of the things that we've talked about is, just to give you an example of what we might consider, is looking at something like the Medicare standard, but adjusting it to make sure it accurately reflects the demographics of the population accessing care. So I think kind of an easy example is thinking about, you might need more pediatricians or something like that, something a little bit different than the standard Medicare population. And I mentioned this factor-based approach would have four main categories, and then the department would make rules to define what factors within those categories an insurer could use to demonstrate compliance. And the bill currently proposes those four categories are access to care that are consistent with the needs of enrollees served by the network, consumer satisfaction, transparency, and the quality of care and cost containment. Right now, the Dash 1 amendments don't perfectly reflect our intent in terms of how we construct the factors and the rules, but I just wanted to be clear that the intent is that the insurance division would make rules that would define within each of those four categories a set of factors, and the insurers could select one or more factors within each category to use in demonstrating their compliance. And so we're going to work on some proposed language that would help better reflect our intent with the factors. And I did want to make one other note, is that the way that the legislation is crafted right now, the minimum standards are applying only to individual and small group. And you know, I think that we've talked a lot about kind of the extent of, the extent of our reach when it comes to large group, which is a huge part of the population. And we think that consumers on large group plans really do deserve the same transparency and the same protections as other consumers, but there's some complexities with large group plans that are a bit unique, and we didn't have enough time to fully explore and discuss those unique features. And so at this point, we're proposing to limit this to individual and small group and engage in further discussions with stakeholders about how this would work for large group. The second piece of this legislation deals with transparency, and we are proposing that there would be a requirement for insurers to post provider directories online and also make them available in writing upon request. And we would set forth in rule requirements about how frequently these need to be updated, and also about the need to have some disclosure for consumers saying, you know, this is the last time that this was updated, and you have a responsibility to contact your insurer and your provider to see if they're covered by this plan. And I think that's just a recognition that there are often reasons why providers might, you know, from one day to the next, not be in a particular network, and they're often not within the control of the insurer. And so trying to recognize that that's sometimes fluid. One final piece is that in preparing this legislation, the insurance division did go through a very extensive and public process. We had a series of meetings over the better part of a year with stakeholders, including consumer representatives, insurers, providers, and we've tried to craft something that balances the need for consumer protection and transparency with the ability for insurers and providers to innovate and still provide care in a way that's beneficial to consumers. And so right now, the draft one amendments I mentioned have a few things to be fixed, but they reflect the feedback that we've received from that group over the last year or so. And we are still receiving some comments on the Dash 1s, and we're committed to continuing to work with stakeholders to resolve any remaining issues. And we think that this is a bill that will help consumers with the needed clarity to make good decisions going forward. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
We'll open it for questions right now, but let me ask you this also. We have a long list of people who want to testify. If you'd be prepared to join us at the end of that testimony to clear up things that are arising, that would be very helpful.
Sure, Green, like, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, well, thank you. Yep. No, who we got? Representative Lively, please.
Thank you, Chair. So the question I have, can you define a little bit more for me what, when you say small group, what does that mean? Is it a number? What is that?
Chair Green, like Representative Lively, so right now Oregon law defines a small group health plan as a plan that's issued to an employer group, and the employer has 50 or fewer employees. In 2016, though, the definition of a small employer will change to up to 100 employees.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Commissioner Kelly.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear from you again today. Without closing this hearing, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2828 and ask Representative Smith-Warner to join us. and Dr. Metz, I think, is also on, online. And in case you hadn't heard, we don't have the paperwork for working this bill today, so we'll reschedule it for a week from Monday, a week from today.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith-Warner, and I am the state representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. Thank you so much for the time today, to make it clear. I come here before you in support of House Bill 2828. As you may know, I replaced now State Senator Michael Denbro representing our district, and I consider this kind of a legacy bill. I am honored to join with Senator Denbro in his longtime support of seeking support for health care, and that is what this bill will do. Sorry, I'm a little off. As you well know, in 2013, this chamber passed House Bill 3260, which authorized the Oregon Health Authority to contract with a third party to conduct a cost-benefit analysis on at least four different options for funding health care in Oregon. That study bill passed with broad support, bipartisan support, and was set to sunset at the end of 2014. This bill before you today, House Bill 2828, will extend that sunset by 2 years. We found that more time has been needed to carry out this study for the Oregon Health Authority to seek out and secure the third party to conduct this study and execute it. A lot of good work has gone into getting the funding for this. The fund that was not passed out with funding 2 years ago, and that has been part of the effort. So we would like to continue that effort and also give this body the opportunity to perhaps provide matching funds, which is why we will be asking for a referral to Ways and Means from this committee. And with that, I will pass it over to my technical consultant, Dr. Samuel Metz.
Yes, sir. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Samuel Metz. I'm a Portland private practice anesthesiologist. I participated a bit in the drafting of the original 3260 bill. My larger role has been as a fundraiser for that bill after its enactment. When HB 3260 was first conceived in 2012, I anticipated that finding private funding would be complete by the time of the deadlines noted in that first study. I was wrong. Contributions have been steady. They have not yet reached a sufficient level to enable the study to begin. HB 2828 would extend the deadline, giving us needed time to complete the private funding of the bill. It would also ask for a state contribution, which would make private fundraising easier and faster. Oregon's quest to provide better care to more people for less money will be an issue in front of the legislature for some time to come. The results of this study could provide the legislature with the economic information to make some very difficult decisions easier. It's also potentially possible that the results of this study, given that Oregon spends about $38 billion a year on health care, could reduce the cost of health care for Oregon's families and employers by $1 billion or more. I respectfully ask the members of the committee to give careful consideration to HB 2828. Thank you very much.
Other questions? I have a question. It's a legislative strategy question, or perhaps tactics question. This bill sailed through, 3620 sailed through pretty easily because it had no fiscal, because it was the determination that the advocates would raise the money to support the studies. But putting a matching amount into the bill, is that going to complicate the passage. I mean, this will go down to Ways and Means, and everybody knows what happens in Ways and Means, which is frequently nothing.
Mr. Chair, I will take one stab at that and then let Sam, who has been doing the fundraising, comment on it as well. I would say I think it both complicates it and it can also, and yet we still, I think, have true potential. We have spoken with some unexpected potential allies who have interest in this because they like the idea of kind of a broad-ranging, nonpartisan, if you will, study whether they may not support the single-payer aspect, and they might just want to get, and they're interested in getting it on paper clearly. So while it does complicate it to some extent, I think we're asking for a small enough amount that it keeps it in the range of the potential.
Dr. Mintz.
Representative Greenlick, the question about what happens in the Ways and Means Committee is above my pay grade, so I will...
It's above all of our pay grades.
I can say that the fundraising has been slowed by a reluctance of many contributors to go first. They're following the adage that the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. I've had several contributors say they'll contribute the last $5,000, but not the first. A vote of confidence from the legislature would rapidly accelerate the fundraising.
I have no question about that. My question is whether there's a mechanism as this goes into the Ways and Means to bring it out without that, if the determination is they're not going to produce money, but they will allow the bill to go through without the financial contribution. You need to make sure it's done in a way that allows that to happen.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick,
yes.
Question, please.
Just thank you very much for your testimony. I think this is work that needs to be done. But just a point of clarification, the summary talks about studying the financing mechanisms, but then in the core of the bill, there's a lot about the delivery of healthcare. So my question is this a study of financing mechanisms for healthcare, or is this a study of delivery methods, or both?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I would say you can't really talk about one without talking about the other.
I would say you can.
I respectfully disagree, but because I think that part of the financing is you figure out how the thought is, how much does it cost to run a system that is administered this way? How much does it cost to run a system that is administered this way? I think that, to me, that's part of the essence of what you're trying to assess.
Representative Bueller, your distinction between the financing of healthcare and the delivery of healthcare is indeed critical. The thrust of this bill was to look at certain defined methods of financing, which answers the question, who gets care, who pays, and how do we collect? And as best we can, not explore the second half of healthcare, which is how do we pay providers. We do know that the healthcare systems in the U.S. and around the world that provide better care to more people for less money than we do now all provide universal care, which is a financing question. They all use multiple delivery systems, and they also use multiple methods of how they finance universal care. When this study is complete, there'll still be additional questions to ask about how Oregon might create a universal health care plan, and it certainly will then be able to focus specifically on delivery questions that you brought up.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We don't have any of the paperwork going forward now, but we'll hope to get that by a week from today. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2828 and continue our public hearing on House Bill 2468 and ask the administrator to call the next panel, please.
Jeff Clark, Vern Sabo, Dave Nessler? Nessler? I'm sorry if I've slaughtered it.
Don't read, write your name clear enough to get it read. You might not get to testify. Any order.
Go ahead. Oh, okay. Yes, good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee members. My name is Jeff Clark. I'm a naturopathic physician in private practice in Tualatin, Oregon. I'm also a member of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians board, and I've been a member of the work group that Commissioner Calley spoke of, discussing the issues of network adequacy for most of last year. Health insurance indeed is very complicated, both for the insurance companies and for the doctor's office that interface with them. If you've interfaced with the insurance company on a retail end, you can understand that it can be pretty confusing at times to get straightforward information as things stand today. For an individual patient, their interest is to be able to have a health insurance plan and then just get the care that they need and not have to even know about all this complication going on in the background. We have examples in California where there have been plans sold on their exchange that were sent to patients who were never able to find a doctor. There's a kerfuffle going on down there right now with more investigations and law efforts going on. We don't want that to happen here in Oregon. So from that point of view, we really think that this is a great idea to have established standards of a network adequacy for health insurers. And then additionally, it's really important to my profession that this bill extend the concept of non-discrimination provider types that has been put into other aspects of Oregon law and is part of the national law. Some insurers are still discriminating against providers, and they're using exclusion from networks as a way to favor one type of provider and to discriminate against others that are not that type. So we see them still putting up barriers to patients who want to, choose naturopathic care for their primary care, including, believe it or not, not allowing coverage for vaccinations, which is a different topic of another day. So in our opinion, it's Oregon's right to decide who gets to practice medicine, not health insurers, and that by having licensed providers able to provide services, it's important that an adequate network also include a choice for the consumer to be able to choose the provider type of their wanting. The Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians' only reservation with this bill is the amendment that reduces it to only 10% of the private insurance market by taking out the large groups. Nevertheless, we support this bill as a very good first step because it has sound concepts on what a network, an adequate insurance network looks like. Thank you.
Yes. Next, Dr. Sabo.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I serve on the Health Evidence Review Commission and also served on this Network Adequacy Advisory Committee. We are in support of the bill as a first step. I think it would be nice to include the large group market, but we are in support at this time. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Dave Nestler-Cass. I'm here representing Moda Health. We've submitted written testimony, so I'll just cover a few of the highlights from our written testimony. We're a health insurer operating in Oregon, and we provide a large part of the coverage on our plans through provider networks, and this is an important topic for us. The networks represent for us a way to maintain quality and also affordability on the plans that we offer. We were pleased to be a member of the advisory committee that Commissioner Calley established for this initiative, and we're generally supportive of the framework that's laid out in the proposal as amended by the Dash One amendments. The think we've got a good balance we're striking here regarding transparency and also a set of reasonable standards for network adequacy. That being said, there is one area that we would like to have the opportunity to do some additional work in, and that's this factor-based standard that Commissioner Cowley referenced earlier. We support the standard. It's really, to us, is a way to have an alternative to the national standard that might be would be established here under the framework. And it's an alternative that would really encourage and allow for innovation. Innovation meaning, for us, ability to work with providers to create partnerships, both now and in years to come, that really can help us with the goals of quality and affordability. So our request at this point in time is to be able to have some additional time to work with Commissioner Cowley and her staff on that factor-based approach. What we'd really like to see is language that recognizes the intention, the point of that standard, the point of being allowing for innovation, and also some protections for insurers to really allow us to create these partnerships and networks around these partnerships with providers, again, that can support quality and affordability in the future. So those are my comments. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would you call the next panel, please, and point out who the panel after that one is going to be as well.
Okay. Sarah Higginbotham, Jesse O'Brien, Jessica Adams.
I'll be this panel, and the next panel will be?
Jeremy Vandehay, Elizabeth Remley, Betsy Earls.
Thank you.
And then just one lone individual after
two,
that.
Two, I think.
Maybe two.
All right.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Higginbotham with the American Heart Association. First, I want to take a moment and thank Commissioner Cowley and DCBS for convening the stakeholder group in the last month and for their commitment to trying to set some consumer protections and create some tools to hold insurers accountable for delivering access to needed healthcare services through their provider networks. The American Heart Association did serve on the adequacy committee, sorry, that's a long word, healthcare network adequacy committee for the last year, and we support the bill and the Dash One consensus amendments that came out of that, those many committee meetings. I'll be quick because I know there's a lot of testimony. One, I just want to highlight the problem again for you. Consumers and consumer advocates all around the country are increasingly concerned about the impact of narrowing health insurance networks and the need for greater transparency and accountability to enable consumers to access the care they need when they need it. The overarching question is this: does a plans network connect enrollees with the right care in a timely manner without them having to travel unreasonably far? I want to highlight for you that I believe that HB 2468 and the Dash One amendments represent consensus, collaboration, and compromise. For example, the American Heart Association does support including large group plans. However, because we think it's important to go ahead and take action and take a step forward, we are supporting this as is. So that was a compromise that came out of the committee's meetings. The two main problems I wanted to highlight, I've already mentioned time and distance. The other is lengthy wait times, which can be an indicator that a network does not have enough providers in its network or not an adequate network. And in summary, consumers and regulators should have confidence that there are an adequate number of hospitals and primary and specialty care providers in the network to provide covered services in a reasonable amount of time and within a reasonable travel distance. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Vandehay.
Jesse O'Brien. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien with OSPIRG,
Excuse me,
Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, statewide consumer group. I second everything said by my colleague, Ms. Higginbotham. Usberg also supports this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. We think this will provide the Department of Consumer and Business Services with important tools to protect consumers and make health insurance networks more transparent. This is the product of a long, thorough stakeholder process, and it represents the compromise of a number of different points of view on this very complicated issue, which is why the bill is as complex as it is. But to really get to the bottom of this, there's two things that this bill does that answer a really urgent need in Oregon law and Oregon's consumer protections for people in health insurance plans. One is provider network transparency, which is just making sure that people have accurate, actionable, timely information about who is and who isn't in a health insurance network. It is amazing that we do not already have structures in place to enable access to that information, but we really don't. My testimony provides a link to an article in The Oregonian from this fall illustrating just one of a number of Oregonians who have struggled with this over the past year. I'm probably going to butcher this name, but Matthew Mastrantuono was an Oregon consumer who actually came to me with his story about having tried to find an insurance plan that had his very specialized providers in network. He did everything that could be reasonably expected of a person who isn't an insurance expert to make sure that that was the case, and he still accidentally wound up purchasing a plan that did not include those providers.
You didn't butcher his name as badly as I butchered you.
All is forgiven, Chair Greenlake. This bill will give Oregon regulators the tools to begin addressing some of those network transparency problems. And then the second piece is just ensuring a baseline of access to needed healthcare services. The bill will establish a framework for Oregon regulators to begin doing that by providing insurers with the option of either this nationally recognized approach, which will be a pretty prescriptive approach. Or at least this is our assumption, probably based on the Medicare standard, which is a pretty strict time and distance standard. And that will definitely provide a baseline of access to needed healthcare services for consumers. But at the same time, we recognize that that approach is very prescriptive. And if that was the only approach available, it might inhibit the kinds of innovations in and transformations in healthcare delivery that we want to support. And that is the rationale behind the factor-based approach, which Usberg strongly supports. Done right, this could help encourage commercial insurers to implement healthcare delivery system reforms, including advancing Oregon's coordinated care model. The details are going to have to be worked out by rule, but the intent of the factor-based approach is to provide flexibility for insurance companies while also creating a baseline of access for Oregon consumers. So we support the bill. We think it represents a balanced, well-vetted approach to developing a framework to improve health insurance network access and transparency for Oregon consumers. We urge you to support the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Adamson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services. We are both a provider and a payer and participated at length in this process as both. And appreciate very much the work of all of the members of the work group, Commissioner Callie and her team, to really work through a very difficult issue. This is a issue that's been brought up in multiple states in which Providence operates, and I can tell you that the process that we underwent here in Oregon really represents the best about Oregon, bringing everyone to the table, talking through issues, working to find common ground and a compromise. We would note that although it's been a year in the making to bring this bill forward, that we're really at a midpoint. So passing this bill opens yet another opportunity to have a conversation about rulemaking to implement this bill. So we've appreciated the opportunity to be involved to date and recognize that passage of this bill represents yet another opportunity to engage in a lengthy conversation about how to make this work for consumers, payers, and providers.
providers. We are supportive of the Dash 1 amendments. They continue to get us down a road that meets the consensus of the work group. We appreciate that Commissioner Calley noted that there's additional work on those Dash 1 amendments, of which we have provided comment around two issues. One, clarity in the either this legislation or other, that OID, the Oregon Insurance Division, retains authority to regulate network adequacy that doesn't belong to the exchange, that will be dealt with in Senate Bill 1. But the reality is that, that regulatory authority belongs with the insurance division and should not be construed to be in two entities. The second issue related to the individual and small group plans, we support this compromise to apply this to individual and small group only. We have some recommended language to provide some clarity around that. Again, this has been a lengthy process, one that we've been pleased to engage in. Represents a really good process as a compared to other states, and certainly we look forward to continue to work on amendments to make this bill even better. Thank you.
Any questions in this panel? Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, does that, by saying that you support the small group and individual inclusion, do you have problems with the large group? And if so, could you articulate those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes, we support individual and small group. We would not support large group. The needs of the individual and small group market are different than those of large employer markets. And there's a wide range of reasons why that is, that they're a different kind of flexibility, and that's been well recognized in Oregon insurance statute for a long period of time. There is considerable flexibility on the large group market that is not provided for by the small group market or the individual market. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that individual and small group, you've got limited numbers of folks. And so you really want to make sure that there are strong consumer protections there, because the flexibility to be responsive or to, the need to protect smaller consumers is pretty important. But there's been a long history of providing additional flexibility in the large group market. We believe it's important to maintain that here.
Okay.
Well, if we had time, I guess I would ask those who think that the large group should be included, maybe you could answer the same question, why you think it should be.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Geyer, I believe that all Oregonians deserve to have a baseline of access to healthcare services, and they deserve to have the same guarantee of that access no matter where they get their coverage. And I agree that the fact that large group plans are structured differently, regulated differently, means that there are some different issues there that would need to be resolved in terms of how this sort of framework would be operationalized within the insurance division. But I don't think that is a reason to not apply these same standards to large group plans.
Okay, thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Next panel, please.
Jeremy Vandehay, Elizabeth Remley, Betsy Earls.
I don't know how I mix you up with Jesse. He's so much better looking than you are.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, first, Jeremy Vandehay for Kaiser Permanente. First of all, I'm not better looking. And second of all, I'm just pleased that my beard disguise has finally worked. It's taken me 5 years. Just quickly, a lot of the folks who've previously testified captured the points we wanted to make. First, I want to thank Commissioner Calley and her team. We've seen this be a really difficult and divisive topic in other states. I think everybody agrees carriers should have adequate networks. It comes down to the details of how you measure that. And so we really appreciate her team's effort to hear out stakeholders on both sides and try to find some middle ground, which we really feel like they've done here, and we really appreciate the hard work they've put into this. We support the general direction of the bill. There's some details that are still to be worked out, and we look forward to working with the division over the next few weeks to finalize some consensus amendments. Our reasons for really supporting this bill have been alluded to in previous testimony. The traditional way of measuring network adequacy has really been time and distance focused. It's easy to measure, but it doesn't necessarily represent quality of care. It doesn't represent timely access, whether patients are actually getting the right care at the right time. That's a much more difficult thing to measure, but we feel like is the more important thing to measure. And so this bill really strikes sort of the middle, creates a two-track approach, allowing for a nationally recognized standard. If it ends up being Medicare, that's a very time and distance intensive standard, but it's something that people also know. The more factor-based approach, we hope, will be show better indicators of people actually getting access to the right care at the right time. And so it sort of creates this transition where it provides flexibility. It provides both a known standard and a more flexible one. So with that, again, want to just thank the committee for hearing the bill and thank OID for their hard work on this.
Family?
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Cambia Health Solutions. And I just want to make a quick note that Betsy Earls probably will not be sitting right in this chair ever because she can't clone herself and is in another committee testifying at the same time. So if you guys wanted to work on cloning, I think many of us lobbyists would appreciate that.
I have enough to put up with one of you.
Man, you're in rare form today.
Fair point.
You really want a panel of Representative Greenlake up here.
Endless entertainment, Representative Widener. Cambia wants to just echo everything that our colleagues in the insurance industry have said today. We do really appreciate Commissioner Calley's work and her team on this. It was a robust discussion in the work groups. We are here, but we have some work that we want to do. There are some things to clarify, especially around the requirements for the networks, what the factors will be, all that kind of stuff. You guys have heard everything already. So we do want to say we support the intent of the bill. Network adequacy is important, and the things that we're trying to get at with this bill are really important to our enrollees, and we're trying always to be better at them. So we want to make sure that we can get this bill right so that we can continue to work on it.
I know you can't speak for Betsy, but you think she has, her testimony would be in opposition to any of this?
I think that she had very similar testimony to ours.
With some points
ours.
She wanted to.
Yes. So.
Are there questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last witness?
BJ Kavnor.
And then Commissioner Calley, one more time.
I could have just joined and been the third up here. Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is BJ Kavnor. I serve as executive director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are the Chronic Healthcare Collaborative in Oregon. I first want to begin, and I know that everyone's doing this, but it wasn't in my head when I was writing this, but I truly want to compliment Commissioner Calley and her staff for their work on this and their work in general. We had the commissioner as a guest for a patient advocacy summit last month in Portland, and it was absolutely incredible. The feedback that we received from the people who attended the panel were just amazed to have an insurance commissioner come and speak to them and be a voice to begin having conversations with around this. So absolutely incredible. We do support the bill as well with the draft, with the dash one. I've submitted written testimony, but our concerns are continued work in the areas of cultural competency, network adequacy standards, providers and specialty provider availability throughout the state, improved access and a definition of unreasonable delay, a formulary inclusive of all the drugs that patients require with actual cost for 30-day supply, and not just a percentage estimate. This speaks to transparency as well, and this is one of the things that we hear time and time again is a barrier for people being able to choose the plan correctly that's best for them. A simple process for patient appeal of a drug or procedure, and just continued transparency in providers, formulary, and cost of services available to patients. In closing, we look forward to the opportunities that this will bring us in helping us to reach the goals of the Triple Aim, and we truly think that we can do this by working together with the insurance commissioner. Are there any questions?
Thank you, BJ.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
I have about 20 questions that I was saving. Is he the last one? Because I just wanted to...
He's the last one. Why don't you submit it to him in writing?
I'll just pass.
Thank you, BJ.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I'm happy to speak to you afterwards.
I was kidding because I have to come back here till probably 9 o'clock tonight for more committees. So.
Thank you. Okay. Commissioner Calley, will you join us? It would be helpful for you to educate the committee about who you regulate, about the issue of the individual, the small group, the large group, Medicare supplements, CCOs, the insurance exchange. How do you fit into that picture in terms of?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, again, for the record, Laura Calley, the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer Business Services. So the scope of the regulatory authority of the department is for the commercial market. So that means not the Oregon Health Plan, CCOs, that's within kind of the purview of the health authority. But it does mean that we regulate individual health plans for people who buy their own health insurance. We regulate small group. And I mentioned before that's the health plan sold to employers of 1 to 50 employees. And we also do have regulatory authority over a large group, which is more than 50, but the extent of our authority is different, as you know, you've heard many people mention here when you get into the large group space. We also do not regulate self-insured plans, and that includes, I guess, a little bit of a different story, but we also don't regulate PEB, OEB, public plans that are self-insured or fully insured. So just wanted to be clear on that. We do have some regulatory authority over the Medicare supplement plans, but that is also a bit different than the extent of our authority over individual and small group. There are negotiations that occur at the federal level in terms of how those are structured and the rating. But the largest extent of our regulatory authority is really focused on the individual and small group markets. And the reason for that, I think it was alluded to in prior testimony, but that's where you have a much more kind of direct-to-consumer experience. You have either individuals buying their own health insurance, or you have a small business that's buying health insurance for their employees. And the logic there is that typically they're going to be a less sophisticated purchaser of insurance. When you get into the large group space, and I won't speak kind of for every large employer, but many of them either employ someone who's focused full-time on benefits, employee benefits, and is a bit more sophisticated about what they want to offer their employees, or they work with a broker who's doing a bit more of that work for them. So it's a bit more of a level playing field when you get to the larger employer space. But at the individual and small group level, you tend to have individuals who just have less knowledge and less experience in the insurance market.
And the exchange that may be moving over to DCBS, what role do you play? It's a trick question.
So, Chair Greenlick, so since Senate Bill 1 has not yet passed, it does not the exchange is currently not overseen or administered by DCBS, but the insurance division has and continues to work closely with Cover Oregon now. There are a number of things where there's a kind of a regulatory part of the process, and then plans, for example, health plans have to be approved by us for sale, and then once they're approved, they're reviewed by the exchange to make sure they meet their exchange requirements. So there are some...
Would some of these transparency issues relate to them as well?
So Chair Greenlick, as this is drafted, the bill would apply to all individual and all small groups. So that would include on-exchange and off-exchange plans. And one of the things I think I failed to mention in my initial testimony is while the network standards that we're proposing would apply to individual and small group, we are proposing that the provider directories also apply to large group. So I just wanted to make that clear. There is a distinction there. But the bill would apply to plans whether they're sold on the exchange or off of the exchange.
Okay, are there any other questions of the commission?
Question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick.
You would, too.
What?
No, go ahead.
I have a question regarding our, and you may have kind of answered this, but one of the provider networks that I think is very challenged geographically is our patients that don't fall under the Oregon Health Plan into a CCO, and so they remain, for various reasons, covered under open card, for lack of a better term. And these patients find, I think...
It's 100,000 people.
Yeah, about 100,000 people. So I don't think they would be. I don't think that would be considered small in your terms here. But I think it's one of the most challenged groups, particularly in rural Oregon, to have access to adequate care. So my question is, will those folks, those 100,000 folks, through the Oregon Health Authority, be part of this?
Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Hayden, and so just to clarify, we're talking about this is a population of people who is actually
open card Medicaid.
The way that the bill is crafted, this really focuses on commercial plans that we regulate. So individual, small group, and I don't believe that falls within this category of what's included in the bill. But I do want to mention, I think it's a really relevant point because we've talked about the more rigorous, or I'd say not rigorous, but the more, rigid standard that Medicare applies of time and distance. We also realize that may not necessarily work as you get out into rural parts of the state, or that might need to look differently. And so we did make an effort of having people on our advisory committee who represented rural Oregon and could speak to the differences and the challenges that people on commercial plans in parts of the state where there just isn't, there aren't as many options for care. And so we think that the factor-based approach in particular will allow for more recognition of some of the unique ways and innovative ways that insurers and provider networks are going to provide care to their rural customers.
But to your question specifically, this wouldn't apply because it's the state rather than the insurance company.
Can you follow up on that? Well, I think this concept, the intent is to help who's receiving the care, the patient. And I think we have an opportunity here if we did include this 100,000 or so population in it. I think the state would learn an awful lot from their own processes of how that type of care is being provided. Like currently, like you said, how Senate Bill number one, if that doesn't change, there are some other bills out there. Currently, in 2017, the prior DCOs and the MCOs go away, and those are the hugest network, I think, right now that are providing for this 100,000 patients. So it's something I would be interested in having included if that were a possibility.
Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Hayden. So I just want to make sure that I don't speak for my colleagues at the Health Authority, since, you know, really the extent of my expertise and my authority really is on the commercial side. But, you know, we do think this is a really important thing for consumers in the state.
Senator Buehler?
Yeah, thank you very much. I applaud your efforts. This is work that really needs to be done. I'm interested in hearing more how you're going to really do this factor-based approach with regards to such more difficult factors such as the transparency issue and cost containment. How are you going to rate that? How are you going to make it comparable between health systems? I'm curious.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Buehler, I agree that the challenge of operationalizing the factor-based approach is going to be new for us, and we have not yet gotten to the point of kind of fully talking through exactly how those rules will be structured. But the concept is that there might be a number of different ways that an insurer shows how they're meeting something like transparency or, you know, balancing cost and quality of care, and that we would come up with some different ways that an insurer might demonstrate how they're meeting that goal. And an annual report would be submitted to us, reviewed for us. Reviewed by us, and we'd have the opportunity to, to review, engage in discussion with insurers and understand kind of how they're actually meeting those standards. And, you know, I think that there might be some more traditional ways that insurers are providing transparency. You know, provider directories are one of them. I know that they're, that certainly it's a priority for insurers to make sure that their members know what they're buying and that they they actually get value out of their coverage. But we also want the rules to allow for flexibility and innovation. So I'm happy to come back and report as we get more into the details of the rulemaking. But, you know, at this point, we still haven't fleshed out some of the details about how we're going to operationalize this.
Yeah. Follow up, please. Sure. Yeah, I understand. I don't want to get into the details, but I just encourage you. I think it's more valuable to the consumer if they're comparable between plans. So if I appreciate wanting to allow flexibility, but I also think you decrease the value of that information if it's not comparable. And I see easily how you're going to do it for access and consumer satisfaction. Those tools and metrics are easy, are attainable and mm-hmm. standardized. But the other ones, I worry about how you're going to accomplish that goal so it's worthwhile and just not an unnecessary burden on the insurers.
Chair Green, like Representative Bueller, I agree that, you know, finding a way as best as we can to make this comparable is going to be useful for consumers. And I think that that's, you know, kind of the goal here is to help consumers have better information so they can make better decisions. So I agree that to the extent that we can make this comparable without getting to a fully prescriptive standard on the factor-based approach, we're absolutely going to seek those opportunities. And thank you for making that really important point.
President Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to stay quiet most of the time.
You've done a good job.
Do my best.
Self-control.
I practice self-control, and I just wanted to put on the record one of the other things that we probably should be looking at and kind of following up on what Representative Bueller was saying is some of the cost shifting that goes on because of, I mean, you don't have access to the Medicaid programs, but looking at reimbursement rates of what Medicaid is versus Medicare and all the other things where a lot of offices are having to make up for money that they're losing by taking some of the patients and factoring all of that in to where we can get a real idea of what costs are, because even when you get in the medical community, I don't think all of them know truly what their costs are. I mean, if you ask anybody how much it is for an x-ray and this doctor's visit, nobody usually knows. I mean, I'll see bills come in just off our own insurance, and you don't see a lot of that. But I think cost shifting is something that's affected the cost of healthcare tremendously, and that's one of the things I hope you look at as you're going through and doing all of this as well.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Widener, and so, you know, I agree that that's an important thing for us to be able to get our arms around kind of as a system. I think that the intent of network adequacy is not to dive into the details of contracted reimbursement rates or to look at provider contracts specifically. I think right now our best authority to deal with issues around cost is within our rate review authority for individual and small group plans. I don't think that gets so far as to understanding how differing reimbursement rates between Medicaid, Medicare, and the commercial markets, how that all is fitting together. But, you know, I think the concept with network adequacy is not so much to get to the point of, you know, getting into the contracts themselves, but also making sure that that consumers are getting the care that they need, and that when they buy an insurance product, that they know that it's got some minimum level of value to them, and that they also know, you know, can know at the outset whether a provider that they're interested in seeing is covered. So I don't think that was the intent of this particular bill at this point.
Thank you. When will the insurance report, the annual report, come out?
Chair Greenlick, so we are working on an updated electronic version of the health report, and I don't have the ETA on with me right now, but it is later this year. I think it will be during session, but I'm happy to confirm
during
that and get
session,
back to you.
I'd really like you to brief us on that. It's a very interesting report.
I would be happy to do that. We're kind of refashioning it a little bit because for those who may not be familiar with it, it's been published every year, and it's a bound report. It just kind of goes over the state of the market. And we're looking at publishing that in electronic format that you know, is a bit more nimble, and we can update more easily. Mm-hmm. But I will be happy to report back on the timing of that.
That's great. You've done a great job in bringing this topic to this point. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Very
members
much.
Of the committee. Thank you.
I close the public hearing on 2468. Look forward to getting some amendments.
2468. Yeah. I can remember that one. Chair, I can remember
that's
that bill.
Right.
2468?
That
yeah.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah, until you said
who
that.
Who do we appreciate?
Chair,
no.
We are adjourned until Wednesday.
Thanks.
Adjourned until Wednesday.